From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we go to Houston, Texas, where the Green Party is holding its national convention. Dr. Jill Stein is expected to be the party's nominee for president. She has chosen Ajamu Baraka, the activist and political commentator, as her running mate. Bruce Dixon from Black Agenda Report and Green Party member Howie Hawkins from New York spoke about the history of political parties, how political parties raise funds, and what the Green Party needs to do to compete in a workshop at the convention Friday.
We want to talk about the Green Party, and we've got a problem. We used to be a party of local chapters. People paid dues. We were represented nationally, proportioned to the membership. And in the 90s, state parties started getting ballot lines, and they said, hey, in California, we got 100,000 registered members and only 500 paid members. We should have more power in the national party. And it became this big struggle over whether we're going to represent actual living, breathing people who supported the party or virtually represent people who told the state they're in the party, no matter what their politics. And I'm not going to go into the history of how that fight went on throughout the 90s, but in the end, we ended up with the same model as the Democrats and Republicans, enrollment parties where power structure is dictated by state law. And the problem is we lost our funding base and we lost our grassroots organized base. So we defunded and disorganized ourselves. And Bruce and I believe the solution is that we need to go back to that other model. And we're going to go over the history of parties, how they developed, how this mass membership party is an invention of the left. It was how they competed with the top-down parties that were the first parties as parliamentary systems or legislative systems developed. And talk about the things the solution can do is finance it. And the idea that the little people won't make little contributions and fund a mass movement, the Bernie Sanders campaign disproved that. 2.5 million contributors, what did they raise, 150 million or more?
200.
200 million, okay. So the idea that we can't fund it with the little people, I think has been disproven. We believe the solution enables mass participation. We talk about grassroots democracy, but if you can't go to your local Green Party meeting and talk about what's an issue we got to address, how we organize a campaign, what our positions should be on something, who our leaders should be, even if our leaders are not representing us, how we replace them. You don't go to your local Democratic committee to decide how we're going to fight for a $15 minimum wage in the city or how we're going to fight TPP. You go to the old party committees basically to get network. You want a job with the city public Department of Public Works, you want a contract from the mayor, you know, you start paying your dues in the party committees, which just mobilize people. They are not what we think of when we have a green local meeting where, you know, we talk about issues and how we're going to organize. So if we're going to have a mass party, we've got to have a way for the masses to get engaged. We think one of the missions of a party should be to unite us, the people, the working people. We're divided by race, obviously. We have increasing geographic race and class segregation in this country over the last four decades. And within the working class, we're divided between union, non-union. The non-union kind of resent the union benefits that the unionized people got. It's big and small business, different kind of work. You work alongside your boss in a small business, you got a different mentality than if you're working for a big corporation in a management hierarchy. You've got public workers and private workers. Public workers, generally, although these were, they're losing this, have defined benefit contributions. Private workers tend to have been moved over to the defined contribution, formal 401k program. So private workers resent the public workers. So we got those divisions. Then we got all these people in the prison system, in the welfare system, who are working class. And you got some working class people that are sitting on the other side of the bars watching them, or the other side of the desk, you know, dealing with their benefits. And so we need a place where people can come around in a city across these divisions and find their common interests. And this is not going to happen by, you know, social media saying let's treat each other with respect or deal with our white supremacy or whatever. We got to get down face to face and hammer out you know, and find out what our common interests are. That's something that a party needs to do. Our party should be involved in building social movements, not just joining them. And Bruce is going to talk more about that later, because the nonprofit industrial complexes with the big money behind it is kind of dictating our agenda. And finally, it should be a place where we do political education. So, okay. So,
the Green Party is are we a fit home for the thousands of folks who are looking for a political home right now? Anybody thinks we are?
Ideologically, yes.
Well, ideologically, but if in your state 200 people walked in the door tomorrow or 300 walked in the door tomorrow, could you handle that administratively or any other way? You couldn't do it. And who thinks there aren't 300 people in California or Illinois or Pennsylvania or Georgia? There are. I guarantee you there are. So we can't handle it. Anyway, why can't we handle it? Because we're too weak to compete, we're underfunded and understaffed, we're unable to communicate, like how we just said, and why?
Okay.
We're too weak to compete because we're imitating the organizing model of Republicans and Democrats. Democrats and Repubs both use 1% of money and corporate media to communicate with their followings and to lead a mass following. And their candidates and their campaigns are completely independent of and completely not responsible to their local party organizations or their voters. Look at Donald Trump. How did he get the nomination?
Money.
He bypassed, He bypassed all the local Republican organizations, all right? And he used his reality star cachet and lots of free media that they gave him for no good reason, and he won the primaries. Bernie demonstrated his independence from his base too by uncritically embracing Hillary despite the, you know, what a lot of his followers wanted. There you go. The Green Party has been following their model, only without the money and without the media. How's that working? Why is the Green Party in this state? Again, because we're imitating their model, and we just covered that. Also, we said we're imitating their model. The Jill Stein campaign. I've been working for the Jill Stein campaign. The Jill Stein campaign has 5 or 6 times the number of employees and many times the budget of the National Green Party. Mm-hmm. There you go.
And that's true with the Democratic and Republican parties. They are not only capitalist ideologically, they're capitalist as an institution because the real power structure in the Democratic Party are not the formal committees. Like I said, that's where you go to network, you know, to get a job or a contract. The real power structure are the campaign organizations. Each candidate is an entrepreneur. They hire some people they form a little company, and then they seek the investors. And the big money, the fat cats invest in these different campaigns and largely determine who comes out on top. And so that's the real dynamic there. Now, in the Greens, it's a little different in that we don't accept corporate money, but we have people who, you know, basically professional class people who got more time and discretion over their time and more money, and they tend to dominate in our politics in the informal structure we've got. And one of the things we're talking about, this mass membership structure, is not only the grassroots members supporting it financially, but having a way to hold the whole organization accountable to them at the base. So that's where the Greens are a little bit different than the Democrats and Republicans, but the problem is our formal structures aren't really providing the leadership and the accountability. It's the initiative of candidates. And when I ran for governor, I raised $200,000. The state budget of our party is around $20,000. So there you go. And the Greens' national budget, after we pay $100,000 for fundraising, we have about $200,000 to spend. You know, that's the size of a basically underfunded nonprofit in the hood. You know, it's not, and we're trying to be a national party. So that's why we're saying we need to look to a different model.
So where's the money going to come from? Where? Dues. Come on. What do people pay in church?
Tithes.
Well, they call it tithes, but it's still dues, isn't it? What's the difference? Okay. Dues give us the financial resources we need, The Sanders campaign is only the most recent example that the money is out there. It's also proved by the existence of tens of thousands of churches, small and large, that run off the tithes of willing believers, who are often the poor.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if people are willing, if they buy what you're doing, they'll contribute. Dues give us the financial resources we need. The other thing is that locals, underneath the national and underneath the state, you can organize by counties, but, you know, whatever you want to call it, but Georgia, where I live, has, 112 counties, is that right?
159
counties. A couple of counties have a population of 2,000. Mm-hmm. The county I live in has a population of 700,000, and there's one county floating with 1 million, and
and
three more counties with 800,000. So if you're organizing by counties, then are you going to give the 2,000 people the same voice as the 1 million people? I don't know if you want to do that. But locals do enable mass participation. Locals are where your grassroots people can be active in the party. And again, if the party's not active, who's going to pay dues? And locals give us the grassroots organization for grassroots democracy. They're training grounds. Active locals make possible the accountability of party officials on every level and accountability of campaigns and candidates, which are not accountable often. Party locals are where we can begin to unify the working class by building relationships and solidarity. Solidarity across lines of race, geography, solidarity across occupational divisions. Howie's way ahead of us, isn't he? I told you he wrote this stuff so we could spill it out. Solidarity of big business employees versus small business employees, private sector versus public sector. I mean, what's the difference between a private sector worker and a public sector worker?
One's on the government payroll.
Just who signs the paycheck, that's it. That's it. The only way they want you to think different is so they can get you one at a time. And of course, the difference, solidarity between and among folks who work in the welfare and prison systems and folks who are in the welfare and prison systems. And I don't know what state you're from, but in Georgia, a prison guard is a sub-minimum wage job. That's how the cell phones get in there, okay? They got to make some side money some kind of way, you know? Come on. Party locals are where we can build social movements not controlled by the whims of corporate funders. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on. And where did the nonprofit thing come from? Okay? Some of you have read history from back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, did they have nonprofit organizations and single-issue organizations back then?
No.
Heavens no. Those things are an invention of the funders from the late 50s, early 60s, post-civil rights era, 60s, 70s, that's where it came from. Yeah, before the 1960s and the rise of the nonprofit industrial complex, social movements were not built by single-issue organizations competing for grants. They were built by self-funding, dues-paying parties by labor unions and by farmers' alliances. In the latter half of the 19th century, the labor unions and farmers' alliances organized parties. In the first half of the 20th century, left parties organized unions, consumer rights, peace and civil rights campaigns. Bang. Party locals are where we can conduct political education. We want to change the world, okay? Would you trust a doctor who hadn't studied the human body?
Hell no.
Okay, would you trust a dentist who hadn't studied mouths and teeth? Why should we trust a party whose members don't study how parties are put together and how societies are put together? Who don't talk about it? Do Democrats do political education? Yeah, it's called the TV. Sure they do. It's called CNN and MSNBC. Republicans do it on Fox. And some of it happens in your school, too.
Yeah.
Political education and study groups, forums about social problems, the systems and the power structure. I live in Atlanta. Atlanta's a fairly big city. Metro is like 5 million people. When interesting folks like Howie or somebody come through town, is there a place where we can say, oh, who's going to be in town this 2 weeks? Howie's going to be in town, and after that, 2 weeks later, Cornel West is going to be here. Where is the place where we can take them to have them speak and draw an audience that people are used to coming to? You know where? Nowhere. It doesn't exist. But if we had a dues-paying party, self-financing party, we'd have a stable place to meet. We'd have a hall we could call on, where we wouldn't have to labor under the stuff that you do when you get somebody's church and they say, well, you know what, you can use the hall here, but you can't talk about politics, you can't talk about running for office.
You can in my church.
And it, well, some churches you can, but many you can't. Okay, and some other places you can, many, and you can't and you can't collect any money. But you got to pay us for the hall. Mm-hmm. But you can't collect any money. Mm-hmm. Come on. Political education. We're talking about political education, about what our policy platform of socialism ought to be. Political education about how to organize and maintain party bodies. We'll talk more about that, issue campaigns, electoral campaigns, and more. Hey, a brief history of political. I'm going to turn this over to Howie. Howie did. Howie's got big shovels, and he apparently dug all this stuff up here. So, deal.
Well, there's a lot of information in the outline, and I'm not going to go over it in detail, but historically, parties came from the top down. We had representative bodies back even the Roman Senate, you know, and they had factions. They had the patricians representing the landed elite, the nobles, and the plebeians representing basically the merchants and the middle class. And then they kind of disappeared until we started getting representative assemblies starting in England, the English Civil War, English Revolution. Different classes started fighting for who would have the power. So the parliamentarians, or the roundheads, opposed the royalists or the cavaliers in England in the Civil War, and by the time the revolution in 1688 came out, the pro-parliament Whigs were fighting the pro-monarchist Tories. And that was the beginning of parties. And in the United States, it came from the legislative caucuses, the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians. And the Hamiltonians were tended to be pro-England, pro-monarchy, the Jeffersonians, pro-revolutionary France, pro-democracy, except when the Haitian Revolution happened, they weren't for that, you know, because a lot of them were planters and slave owners. So a lot of contradictions there, but basically that was the first party system, came from the top down. Nominees were appointed by these legislative caucuses, but as Republican ideals spread amongst the people, they were demanding we shouldn't have a property qualification on the vote, we should all vote. And so in the Jacksonian era, which was the second party system, they got rid of the property qualifications. And then an American invention was a convention. What we're doing today was invented by a third party, which was the, I think it was the anti-Mason party up in New York in 1830. And then the platform started coming in the same period. It was third parties that kind of raised it at that period. And so the Hamiltonians disappeared, the Federalists who, you know, were kind of anti-democratic, and you had, you know, the Whigs and the Democrats, and that was the next party system. Next party system was growing out of the Liberty Party, abolition, which evolved into Free Soil Party, which was free labor, free men, free labor, free soil, and free speech. And that became the Free Soil Party and then the Republican Party. And so by the mid-50s, 58 election, the Republicans established them as the second party in Congress. And then Lincoln was actually a second party candidate, not a third party candidate, in a four-way race. And that led to the Democratic and Republican system, which has evolved with different dominant coalitions. But in that period, third parties were very important. Not just the Liberty Free Soil Republican effort, but after that, the Farmer Labor Populist parties. They defined, as did the abolitionist parties, the issues that were debated in their time and elected thousands of people from local, state to Congress, and senators, governors, They were called first the Greenback Labor Party, then the Anti-Monopoly Party, then the Union Labor Party, and finally the People's Party. And they fought for civil rights. They fought to reestablish Reconstruction. General Weaver, everybody knows he was the People's Party candidate in 1892 and got 6-7% of the vote, but he was the Greenback Labor Party in 1880, and he was running around the South under armed protection to make sure the Klan didn't break up meetings, which they insisted be open to everybody, black and white, and so they were fighting the imposition of what became Jim Crow. That was a 20-year fight in which third parties, in a contradictory way, but definitely were fighting the imposition of Jim Crow and the disenfranchisement of black people and also poor people in the South, because when they put a poll tax or a literacy test, it not only affected black folks, it affected poor white folks. But that was another party system, and then they evolved. The New Deal Coalition broke up, started in the 30s, broke up in the 80s, and then we have two very conservative parties since that time, and you can call it neoliberalism or the imposition of austerity. But the point is, the party systems change, and today, you know, Glenn Ford at Black Agenda Report, a guy named Michael Lind, who's with one of these think tanks, people are looking at what's going on now, where you have a rebellion from below of the voting base against the elites controlling both parties, which have imposed austerity on the working people and got us involved in a bunch of damn wars that people really don't want to be involved in. So the party system may be breaking up right now. You've got the corporate militarists, definitely got the Democratic Party with Clinton. You got the Sandinistas who really don't, there's a contradiction there. And we're the party where they ought to be. And we're getting some indication people are coming to us. So that's the Democratic coalition splitting between progressives and the corporate militarist elites. And then on the Republican side, there's three factions fighting for the Republican brand. You've got the old Republican, the country club Republicans, the Wall Street Republicans, the corporate militarists, pretty much like Clinton. Some of them are supporting Clinton this time because they can't stand Trump. They're trying to hold on. And then you got the Trumpists. Now, Trumpism to me is whatever's good for Donald Trump. I mean, I don't think he stands for anything but himself. But the base has said, we don't want our Social Security. We don't want entitlement reform. We don't want our Social Security cut. We earn those benefits. And we don't like these foreign wars. And we don't like what your Republican elites have been doing. We're downwardly mobile. This is, white working class and middle class folks. Our life expectancy is going down. So we got issues. And so we're voting for this guy that seems to be thumbing his nose at the establishment. So that's the Trump faction, the populist faction. And then you've got two Republicans running on the Libertarian ticket, two former Republican governors who are trying to represent sort of the moderate Republican, socially liberal, an older type of Republicanism that's pretty much been pushed out of the party but still exists. So it's very interesting. But what does that mean for us? Like Bruce was saying earlier, we could be flooded. And are we organized enough? Do we have the resources to respond to these people who expect when they say, I want to help, for somebody to get back to them and help them help? Mm-hmm. And so that's why we need to think about how we're structured. So the other part of the history, you want me to go into the different party structures? The legislative caucus system was top down. I talked about that. So you came with the open convention system as a response. So these third parties and eventually the Democrats and Republicans, when it's time to, this is the 1830s, 40s, 50s, in the 19th century, when they want to have a national convention, and when a third party wants to start a third party, they say, everybody interested in this, come to the precinct caucus, and we're going to elect delegates to the county convention, and the county convention will elect delegates to the state convention, and the state to the national. More democratic than the top-down legislative caucus system, but the problem is, when the doors are open to whoever wants to show up, and there's no commitment to the party and say financially in terms of dues or agreement with a set of political principles, you can get a situation where, and this happened in the 1890s with the People's Party, in 96 they ended up cross-endorsing the Democrat. The populist delegates from areas where the Farmers Alliances were organized, they tended to be for we're going to run our own candidate. But in the areas where they were not well organized, you had opportunists from the major parties showing up. Republicans in the South, Democrats in the North, and they wanted to do fusion, coalition with the populace in order to get elected. And that wreaked havoc in terms of the state People's Party and before that Greenback Labor and Union Labor.
Yeah, when you don't have a party, when you're relegated to having the nonprofits lead the movement. I was at a meeting in North Carolina. Where's Michael at? I was at a meeting in North Carolina where they were championing fusion. There was a room full of people, 75, 80 people. Joe was there. And they were saying, the way to go is, what's the word? Fusion is the way to go.
And confusion led to confusion in the 19th century. And eventually, when they cross-endorsed William Jennings Bryan, that was the end of that whole series of farmer labor populist parties. You see what the reason is that anybody could show up. And they came there with different agendas, so you couldn't really control what was going on. And I just want to read a quote from Lawrence Goodwin, who, you know, is one of the foremost historians of populism. And he said, in the populist moment, in democratic terms, the structural weakness of the People's Party evolved from the failure of its organizers in the founding convention in 1892 to understand that the third party, to be authentically democratic, had to be organized as a mass party with a mass membership. Instead, it was organized, like all large American parties before and after, as a representative party, with elite cadres of party regulars dominating the organizational machinery from precinct to national convention. The People's Party spoke, rather more tellingly than most American parties have ever done, in the name of the people. But in structural terms, the People's Party was not made up of the people. It was comprised of party elites. Its ultimate failure, therefore, was conceptual, a failure at the theoretical level of democratic analysis. Here's the quote. So you see what he's saying. They had these farmers' alliances. They had between the Colored Farmers Alliance and Cooperative Union in the South, the White Farmers Alliance in the South, the Northern Farmers Alliance. They had 7.2 million dues-paying farmers, agricultural workers, and allied industrial workers, the remnants of the Knights of Labor and so forth, paying dues. Instead of delegating from those local organizations to their conventions, they said, we're going to open up a parallel structure. Anybody who wants to show up, show up. So these opportunistic Democrats and Republicans, and eventually diluted the populist program and their political independence. Now, the other thing that was going on with this open convention system was party bosses, urban machines. And the reason we ended up going to primaries, the progressive movement said, we got these bosses. And so when they call the precinct caucus in the machine area, you know, you got thugs sometimes saying, you're in because you're with us, you're not because you might not be. And basically the bosses controlled from the top down. And in the end, the smoke-filled rooms, you know, decided who the nominees would be. So the progressive movement said, oh, we're going to do the primary system as a way of getting out of the smoke-filled rooms. But they were also aimed at the Socialist Party, who kept Democratic conventions. You had to be a member to go to their conventions, and they were taking over cities. So the progressives was, you know, in the popular rhetoric, it was going after these machine bosses, but it was also going after the Socialist Party. So from 1900 to 1920, primaries spread across the states. So what have you got there? You know, it's nominally more democratic, but in fact, remember that party structure I talked about, the candidate organizations with the capitalist money invested in them? They pre-select who the people get to vote for when they get to the primary ballot. And in the meantime, the people are atomized, they're not organized, they're not discussing among themselves what our program is and who the candidate should be to represent us. They just show up at the primary, and they've been advertised at by the mass media. Today it's TV, back then it was newspapers. And so it was supposed to be more democratic. In fact, it was just a more sophisticated way of having the open convention system with party bosses controlling. Now, the socialists at the time, they set up a membership organization. Your state party was recognized when you had an X number of locals. And they drew two lessons from the People's Party. First, their party constitution said, we're not going to fuse with Democrats and Republicans, because that killed the populace. Yep, they put it right in their constitution. Secondly, only members who pay dues can vote in party decisions. They decided living, breathing members who are committed to the party enough to give a small donation every year are the ones that are going to make the decisions, not whoever shows up. And one of the things, if you've been involved in movements, when things are exciting, all kinds of people flood up, and it's like, some people think, well, it hasn't worked because I've been here, but now I got all the solutions, you know. And then they create chaos, impose decisions, and then they flood out when the movement, you know, wanes. And the people that are committed there for the long haul are left with their decisions.
We'll hear more next week from Bruce Dixon of BlackAgendaReport.com, who's also the state chair of the Green Party in Georgia, and from Howie Hawkins, a Green Party member from New York, a presentation that they made at the Green Party convention in Houston, Texas, Friday.